One thing some Democrats and Republicans can agree on, identity politics are bad politics. But others see the phrase as an insult used to avoid conversations on race. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, how identity politics are factoring into the 2020 campaign. Also on the show, in Newark, New Jersey, officials are scrambling to respond to an ongoing lead crisis, and residents are speaking out.
Clean water!
And in California, hundreds of thousands of kids don't receive their full child support payments because a parent is on welfare.
I won't take them places, buy them stuff, and it's like, I can't because I'm paying child support. And then it's not really going to support my children.
All right, let's do this. Identity politics. It's a phrase that's been around for decades, but it's been thrown around a lot more since the 2016 election. And depending on who you ask, on the left or the right, it's something that's increasingly seen as detrimental to our politics.
The Democratic Party needs to try and gravitate away from identity politics and towards things that would actually bridge the gap.
We've become this identity politics, the Women's Caucus, the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus. We've lost sense of we.
Identity politics will destroy this country faster than a foreign invasion.
Of course, some prominent Democrats have been pushing back on the idea that identity politics can cost you an election, notably Senator Kamala Harris. This past weekend in North Carolina, she said people, including Democrats, have turned the phrase into the 21st century version of playing the race card.
People bring it up in a way that is meant to marginalize the subject, in a way that I believe is meant to say, hush. When we talk about how our country is and where we are on civil rights issues, it is not about identity politics in the way that they try to phrase it. Where America stands on core issues of civil rights is about America's identity.
Part of the issue is that the term identity politics is often reserved for when candidates talk about issues that affect minority communities, but not for coded appeals to white voters or evangelical Christians. To understand why, we have to go way back in this country's political history. Here to help us break it all down is Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox, and Adam Serwer, staff writer for The Atlantic. Jane, Adam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Jane, let's get started with you. This whole identity politics thing, this has happened earlier in eras of U.S. history, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that when we talk about quote-unquote identity politics, it's worth recognizing that a large swath of our politics is identity politics. So, for example, you know, when we're talking about the populist movement of 1890, that's identity politics. It's based on the identity of farmers. You know, when we're talking about specific groups and how politicians work with those groups, that's not a bad thing. That's how politics works. That's how people can talk about issues that might matter to someone in Xenia, Ohio, and some issues that might matter to someone who lives in downtown LA.
Adam, when we talk about, again, identity politics, it's often like this dog whistle that's being used to attack those on the left. Talk about the strategy that Republicans are using here to deride Democrats.
In a way, denigrating identity politics is itself a kind of identity politics because of the way that the term is typically used to refer to issues that minorities care about. But when you look at the Trump-era Republican Party, it's tremendously about identity politics. It involves a lot of stoking fears about Latino immigrants, Muslim terrorists, black criminality. It's actually a bit misleading to say that someone who says we should strengthen the Voting Rights Act is engaging in identity politics, and a president who says four women of color in Congress should go back to where they came from is not engaging in identity politics. To the extent that the Republican Party under Trump has one consistent story, it is a story that these other people who are different from you are taking the things that you deserve.
And Adam, one thing that we're hearing, I mean, let's be honest, like this is also coming from among the Democratic candidates for president. There are those who have really latched on to the sort of progressive ideals that are now in the zeitgeist, and those that have towed more of a middle of the line approach and use things like we need to appeal to a, quote, broad swath of Americans. What is that strategy all about?
Well, I think that actually speaks to what we're talking about, which is that it's not called identity politics when you're trying to specifically appeal to white people, even though that is a form of identity politics. So when people use those code terms like appeal to a broad swath of Americans, what they mean is they want the Democratic candidates not to say things that are going to scare away moderate white voters who might be more likely to vote for Trump if a Democratic candidate seems too progressive on issues of race and culture. But that is also a form of identity politics. And I think that it is significantly affecting the Democratic Party. I mean, to the extent that Joe Biden is running so far ahead of the other Democratic candidates, I think that has a lot to do with the perception that Biden is less threatening to those swing voters who might feel more uncomfortable with a candidate who is not essentially a white guy.
Jane, let's dig into a little bit what Adam's saying there, because really we're talking about white identity politics here. You kind of mentioned that at the top of the show. How is it viewed, or is it even acknowledged within the Republican Party at all?
I think that there is some idea that it is a specific form of identity politics, but I think that there's a view that it's kind of the identity politics that they have to engage in. And I think it's interesting because it's also calling back to a halcyon era of what the Republican Party used to look like and not so reflective of what the Republican Party looks like now. So when you talk about, for instance, suburban white women who are peeling off from the Republican Party, as we saw in 2018, there aren't really direct appeals towards them, but there are direct appeals towards people working on specific industries that don't employ as many people as they used to, or it's kind of the idea of someone. You know, for instance, when we're talking about the tariff wars, we're talking about bailouts to farmers. We're not talking about, you know, individual mom and pop farms. We're talking about massive, heavily subsidized farms in Iowa and elsewhere that are, you know, obviously very important economically, but they're not what a lot of people think about when they think about the term farmer. And I think one of the most fascinating things that's going on in the Republican Party right now is that you have a lot of Republican consultants and Republican pundits who are using white identity politics while also not being a part of the groups they're talking about. So, you know, when you hear from people who write for the New York Times or First Things, who are based in New York, talking about flyover states and talking about how no one's listening to real America while they're in Manhattan themselves. It's kind of an ironic setup.
Off of that, Adam, I think, you know, looking at the Democratic slate, you mentioned Biden is at the top, partly because he's sort of towing this line, but he also wants the quote unquote Obama coalition of multi-ethnic voters to come out and vote for him. I'm wondering if you can assess a little bit how the other two front runners might or might not be using identity politics, talking about Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren here.
Well, just to be clear, I mean, Biden is left of center. He's a liberal candidate. I think there is a perception that he is culturally more conservative than the other candidates. He's certainly policy-wise, he's more conservative, but he's not a conservative candidate. I think you see in terms of Warren and Sanders, both of them have constructed very populist economic appeals to the left of Biden, but they've also been a bit more forthcoming on civil rights issues in a way that I think Biden has not, in part because Biden thinks that the rest of the party is going too far on things like decriminalizing border crossings or on the issues of reparations for slavery and discrimination against African Americans, to which Sanders and Warren have signaled openness to. So I think, you know, it's sometimes when we talk about identity politics, we sort of pretend that there's no actual policy content to it. But in this case, I think there very much is.
Jane, back in the 2016 election, there was a lot of talk, again, a lot of identity politics, at least when it comes to conservatives and GOP voters, is often shrouded in sort of coded language. And one of those things was economic anxiety. Now, again, that's not to suggest that white Americans were not suffering from economic anxiety, that they weren't dealing with high levels of opioid addiction, et cetera. But let's talk a little bit about how that played into the GOP strategy and whether or not that same economic anxiety argument will hold in 2020.
Well, first and foremost, I think it was a fascinating argument because, you know, some of the subjects you just brought up are not just being felt by white Americans. The opioid crisis has hit African Americans really hard, specifically with rising rates of heroin addiction. But I think that this idea and the concept of economic anxiety is that there are groups that shouldn't be anxious and groups that should be anxious. And so I think for me, I remember the 1990s and hearing a lot about pulling up one's bootstraps and personal responsibility, and then to have the 2016 election focused on a Republican candidate who is making very unconservative arguments about how there's going to be health care for everyone. And that's this idea that there were people who deserve something better and people who don't deserve something better. And so it'll be interesting to see how that's reflected in 2020, because I think that Trump was in some ways the change candidate and Hillary Clinton was viewed as the stasis or everything stays the same candidate. In 2020, Trump will be attempting to run on 4 years of having been president. The idea of making America great again would now imply that he has not been making America great again. And that's what you've seen kind of the change to keep America great, because apparently American greatness was assured in like 36 months. But I think that it'll be interesting to see how that argument works, because in order to square that economic anxiety argument, you're going to have to say that, you know, I've been extremely successful, but also not successful enough for you to choose someone else as president.
Adam, what are some of the Democratic candidates afraid of? I mean, are we not giving white voters, for example, credit for assuming that they can, you know, both process the idea that there are civil rights injustices that affect certain communities, perhaps of color more than others, and while at the same time understanding that things like healthcare and education and jobs are important? I mean, is this fear reasonable and rational?
To go to the economic anxiety argument, the issue is not economic anxiety, it's how you see your problems. Black and Hispanic voters suffered tremendously because of the recession, disproportionately so. But the arguments that Donald Trump made as to why they were struggling did not appeal to them, in part because they were the people being blamed for that economic anxiety. So you always have to look at the ideological lens through which people view their misfortune. And if you go back to 2015, 2016, you can see a lot of Republicans, a lot of websites that were considered themselves conservative, that were once anti-Trump, that are now pro-Trump, who are saying the exact same things that liberals are saying now about the way that Trump appeals or exploits white identity politics. But I think it's rational in the sense that people, Democrats, are afraid that having seen this argument work once, that Trump will be able to exploit people's prejudices once again. I think that that's not necessarily the case. If you look at 2018, Trump went very hard on the sort of migrant caravan, and it did not prevent him from losing the House in numbers that we haven't seen since Watergate.
We'll be watching. Adam Serwer, staff writer for The Atlantic, and Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Brian calling from Pittsburgh. Identity politics is just a code word the GOP uses to make it seem like it's bad to think about minorities and LGBT people when they campaign and vote.
This is Lori calling from Richmond, Virginia. What's happening in the world is affecting all of us, whether it is the environment, whether it's taxes, whether it's violence. It doesn't seem to be picking a creed, color, age group. You know, I think that we've become smarter and we see people as a people.
This is Josh from Fishtown, and I don't believe identity politics play a role anymore. If, you know, states are the laboratories of democracy, it's equivalent to never upgrading your tools. So no, I don't think they serve anyone anymore.
Hi, it's Layla from San Francisco. Identity politics is the recognition that class, race, gender, and sexual orientation impact every aspect of a person's life, and that there isn't just one American identity. At the same time, a nation does need a national identity of some sort. I think our national identity should be based on our rights and values.
But you holding me back, and that's a sound. I mean, I'm calling you back.
Hey, everyone, I'm Tanzina Vega, back with you on The Takeaway. Last night, the MTV Video Music Awards were hosted at the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey. And while the scene inside was one of celebrities, musicians, glitz, and glamour.
Man, what a night. We're celebrating music the way it always was intended. In a hockey rink. In the middle of Newark.
Outside, activists were using the occasion to bring attention to the city's ongoing water crisis.
What do we want? Clean water! We want it. Now!
What do we want?
Clean water!
We want it.
Now!
elevated lead levels in the water. It's a problem that's plaguing cities across the country, especially those that rely on antiquated lead service lines for their drinking water. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, it's not just Newark. Atlanta, Providence, and Pittsburgh are some of the most egregious of the 13 U.S. cities with over 100,000 residents that are dealing with lead in the water. In Newark, lead was found in some public schools as far back as 2016. When Mayor Roz Baraka joined the Takeaway in January, he laid out the scale of the crisis.
We're going to replace about 1,500 lead service lines beginning in March. Obviously, we're going to run out of money. And we have 20,000 of anywhere between 15 and 20,000 lines to fix. We're going to need additional support.
Well, yesterday at a press conference with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, Mayor Baraka announced that the money had come in and that there's now an expedited plan to secure Newark's water once and for all.
With this new money, we're anticipating that no one would have to pay anything to get their lead service lines actually replaced. We are going to replace approximately 18,000 lead service lines in homes across the city of Newark.
But after such a prolonged struggle to get consistent answers from the city, there's still confusion about Newark's plans to provide clean, safe drinking water to its residents. Joining me now is Gwen Hogan, a reporter for WNYC who covers health. Gwen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina.
So on Monday, Mayor Baraka and Governor Murphy announced a plan, as we just heard, to replace all lead service lines in the city in no more than 30 months. Is that realistic?
Theoretically, yes. If they can do what they say they want to do, this would be tremendous, right? There's very few other cities that have replaced lead service lines at this quick of a pace, and a comprehensive fix that would change all of them, because really the water is fine at the source, but it's when it travels through these lead pipes that are connected to the city's water mains that lead is potentially leaching into the water there. But at this point, there's so much distrust between residents and the mayor. There is skepticism about whether he's going to be able to pull this off.
Mayor Roz Baraka on our show in January said he needed money. Yesterday at a press conference, he said he got the money. Where did it come from?
Right. So Essex County, which is where Newark is located, has agreed to issue a loan to Newark. The city will have to pay it back over 30 years, $6.2 million each year. And these funds, $120 million, will allow the city to both expedite the plan to replace all the lead service lines and also make it free for homeowners. Because, as you know, Newark is a low-income city majority. The cost doing this work was going to be up to $1,000 for homeowners, which was a barrier to entry for many.
You were at the protests in Newark right outside of the Video Music Awards. You have some tape from one of the protesters. Her name is Shakima Thomas, and her son tested high for elevated levels of lead. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
To let city officials feel the pain and suffering that we've been feeling since we've been lied to and going through this public health crisis. And also, I don't understand how they can party while our kids are dying.
How common is what Shakima was saying among the protesters you spoke to?
Everyone is affected by this in different ways. But in terms of the water, people have been buying bottled water in some cases for many months. Some were using filters. Now they have to carry crates of water to their homes. There's confusion about whether you can shower in the water, whether you can use it for washing. So this is an everyday thing, right? We need water every single day. They wanted to send a message to city officials, some of whom were attending this event, to say, hey, our children are being poisoned. How can you be celebrating?
We talk a lot about Newark Mayor Roz Baraka, but there's a connection here with former Newark mayor and current New Jersey senator and presidential candidate Cory Booker. Tell me what his connection is to the water crisis.
Right. Cory Booker has been said to have taken a hands-off approach towards the Water Authority at the time. There was widespread mismanagement of funds under his leadership. And during that time of destabilization at the Water Authority, there was a change, a tinkering of the pH levels that led the water to become more acidic, which people who studied this found led the corrosion control treatment to stop working, which is what allowed the lead to begin to leach back into the pipes. Cory Booker's campaign has said, look, we have always been fighting for environmental issues and the people of Newark. We have no responsibility here. But activists and attorneys and others have begged to differ.
When someone has, like Shakima Thomas's son, as she said, has been affected by lead poisoning because of the water, what recourse do the residents of Newark have at this point? I mean, they're basically waiting on the city to take action to change the pipes. That could take anywhere from 2 to 3 years at this point. In the meantime, what happens to the residents?
Right. In the meantime, they have to drink bottled water. You know, the reason why this has come back to the fore recently is because the EPA told Newark earlier this month that they had to give out bottled water. And that happened because there were tests of a few filters that found that the water filters the city had given out were not functioning. So theoretically, you can use a filter and most of the lead will be removed, but that's been brought into question. So now the city is studying that issue to see, were they really not working or was this small study a fluke? And residents are going to have to make do. Everybody has to drink water every day. So they're buying bottled water. The city has 4 distribution sites where they can go get it for free. But if you don't have a car, if you're elderly, it may be hard to get there. The other recourse is there is a federal lawsuit against the city, and attorneys are holding the city accountable in that way in federal court.
Gwen Hogan is a reporter for WNYC covering health. Gwen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Has your city been affected by elevated lead levels in the water? And have your local and state officials responded? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Back with you now on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega with the story out of California, where hundreds of thousands of poor kids don't receive their full child support payments simply because a parent is on welfare.
You know, I have my kids. I won't take them places, buy them stuff, and it's like I can't do that because I'm paying child support, and then it's not really going to support my children.
That's Thomas Lamb Jr., and for a while, he was paying $1,000 a month in child support. But because the mother of his children received government assistance, the family only received $50 a month from Thomas's child support payment. The rest went back to the government.
She would go on welfare, and all the money she received is a debt to me. I have to pay that back. It was like, what's the point of working? Like, they're taking all this money. I still have to pay for my kids' food, clothes, and all this other stuff, but it seemed impossible.
Today, Thomas is in a better situation. His payments got cut in half, and the whole amount now goes to his kids. But before that relief, the payments were a major financial strain, leading him to owe thousands of dollars to the state. Now, lawmakers in California are trying to increase the amount that stays within the families in these situations, something Colorado has already done. Marisa Lagos is a political correspondent for KQED and the co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. She's been reporting on Thomas Lamb's story and what it tells us about the child support system for poor families in California.
I mean, it feels really counterintuitive on a number of levels, right? I mean, on the one hand, if somebody has the ability to pay cash, shouldn't there be a conversation about whether somebody needs public assistance or whether, you know, this extra money could really help? When we talk about people on public assistance, you know, most welfare payments are a couple $100 per child per month, and there's a cap on that. So it's not as if these people are rolling in the dough to begin with. The other thing that I found when I started to report on this was how really there's some broader effects, right? There's the sort of immediate impact on the wallet of the person paying the child support and the family who's not really benefiting from that child support. But then there's these other intangible things. If the non-custodial parent falls behind on payments, they can actually rack up 10% debt a year. That increases very quickly. And a lot of these people, the vast majority in California, are very low income. They're making less than $15,000 a year. So they're, you know, they don't have extra cash. They can lose their driver's license if they don't make these payments. They can lose their professional licenses. And then, of course, all of that can drive them to either not be able to work or maybe to work you know, outside of the sort of normal boundaries so that they're not seeing their wages garnished. And then there's the even more intangible benefits, like what does this do to their relationship with their children and their ex, and how does that impact the long-term sort of health and well-being of these kids?
Was this structured to be like this? I mean, does the government have a rationale for doing this the way they're doing it, or is this just a sort of a bad side effect of a policy gone awry?
Yeah, it's interesting. I tried to really pinpoint that, and it's a little hard to figure out exactly what the motivation was. I mean, we should note that part of this does stem from federal policy. There are federal laws requiring states to essentially collect some of this money and remit it to them to pay back the taxpayer again for these public services. As best I can tell, this really grew out of the sort of welfare queen myths of the 1980s, which was largely, as you know, racially based. This idea that black moms were having kids specifically to collect public benefits, that African-American fathers were acting sort of, you know, in an irresponsible way because they didn't care. And I think that the idea was probably that this would maybe impact that kind of behavior, perceived behavior, we should say, that it might lead to less people having kids or being on welfare. But as we know from decades of research at this point, the sort of, you know, base of those laws was flawed to begin with. And of course, they didn't have that impact because nobody's having a kid to get $100 in public assistance or child support payments. And so I think that, you know, there has been some move on the federal level to tweak this and give states more flexibility. But my understanding is that broadly, this is sort of, this is not the only way that we tend to sort of punish people for being poor and try to claw back those benefits in any way possible.
Your reporting is based in California, but tell me, you mentioned that this is also part of a federal law. Does that mean that this is happening in other states around the country?
It absolutely is. And interestingly, as we've seen, I think more attention paid to the issue of this idea of punishing poor people for being poor. We've seen this around fines and fees discussions, around Black Lives Matter. We've seen it around, you know, a lot of other areas. Some states are trying to fix it. California has a bill that we can discuss, but Colorado actually eliminated this requirement entirely. They decided to say, if you pay child support, it goes directly to the family, and we will reimburse the federal government for anything that they're owed, you know, in relation to those benefits. And they actually saw almost a 65% increase in non-custodial parents paying these child support payments once they knew it was going directly to their kids. So I do think there's a national movement happening. And I think the next question will be, as the states tackle this, if there's enough pressure on the federal government to really change the law in that way.
We know that there's one California lawmaker, Nancy Skinner from Oakland, who introduced legislation this year to try and keep more money within the families. What has been the response to that proposed legislation?
Yeah, so this bill initially would have entirely said any child support money goes to the families, the government keeps none of it, and then the state would have been on the hook for paying back the federal government for that portion. It did get watered down in an appropriations committee. There was concern that it was going to cost the state budget too much money. I'll note Skinner thought that was sort of ironic because she said that most of this is uncollected debt, right? So this is not necessarily money the state's getting, but it's money they're owed, but they may never see. But she feels like this is a step in the right direction. The new bill would say if you are a family with one kid and you're on public assistance, that the custodial parent gets $100 instead of $50 a month. And if there's two or more kids, it's $200. There's a separate bill that she's also supporting that would eliminate that 10% interest that we talked about. And between those two, you know, she really feels like this is a step in the right direction, but she would still like to come back in the coming years and see the state really entirely wipe out this whole debt collection issue and pass all the money on directly to the kids and the families.
Marisa Lagos, with excellent reporting out of California, is a political correspondent for KQED and the co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Marisa, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure, Tanzina.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.